Hello, my name is Isa Mester, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Sheila Ben Habib, Eugene Mayer Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at Yale University, and Senior Research Fellow at Columbia Law School and the Center for Contemporary Critical Thought. Sheila Ben Habib visited Dickinson to deliver a student-initiated Clark Forum program this week entitled The Canary in the Coal Mine, the 1950 Refugee Convention and the Collapse of the Post-World War II International Order. She's joining me today for an interview. Welcome, Professor Ben Habib.
Hello.
So, to start, you occupy a unique space as both a philosopher and a legal scholar. In your view, why is it important to study international law with a philosophical foundation, and why is law maybe even incomplete without a philosophical perspective?
Good questions. Of all the domains of law, international law was always said to be the one that is most ethical, the one that is closest to philosophical issues, and of course, the one that is hardest to enforce. For many scholars, the origins of international law seem to be some kind of natural law. And in fact, international law itself undergoes various historical transformations. You have a Roman Pax Roma, what was called Jus Gentium, the law of nations, but you also have significant literature that emerges about obligations of nations to one another, to natural law and Christian tradition. So international law has always been a difficult to positivize, that is to say, translate into statutes and other guarantees in which we associate with municipal or domestic law, both in terms of its content, which goes beyond domestic law and covers obligations of humans and nations to one another, and because of the difficulties of enforcement, international law has always seemed to be more philosophically interesting than normal statutes, that constitutions and law that nations adopt. And in that sense, I think it is good to be aware of these kinds of implications, and maybe also philosophical concepts can push international law forward in articulation. I mean, we know that the concept of dignity plays a foundational role in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, dignity is not a concept that can be just derived from positive law. It's a moral concept, right? And authors of the UDHR make very clear in their declarations that somehow they were able to come to an agreement on the concept of dignity, although they came from very different philosophical traditions. The concept of dignity seemed to form some kind of common basis, a kind of overlapping consensus. But then, what is the relationship of various kinds of rights that are claimed to the concept of dignity itself? How does it work? How does that construct work? So there are still lots of issues in some of the very basic sort of documents of international law. And I'm really basically talking about human rights law and relevant issues. Yeah.
And that perfectly leads into my next question, which is, what is the connection between human and refugee rights, and what do the regimes kind of have in common, and how are they different?
Refugee rights are a very interesting category in that they are genuinely at the margins of human rights. I mean, I entered this domain through the work of Hannah Arendt in a way. My interest in this grew after I finished my own Hannah Arendt book in 1996, The Reluctant Modernism of Hannah Arendt. And she has this famous phrase, the right to have rights, that what millions of individuals lose in the interwar and subsequently post-war period, particularly in Europe, that's what she's talking about, is the right to have rights. Now, what does the right to have rights mean? It's obvious when you're a citizen or a resident or somehow legally connected to a polity or a territory that you have certain kinds of rights and obligations. But what if you do not have that status? In particular, of course, for her, paramount was the question of those who had lost citizenship, denaturalization. Not only the Jews of Germany who were denaturalized, but also she points out to the fates of, millions of people who escaped Russian Revolution of 1917, millions of Armenians who had escaped the Ottoman genocide right after, the last years of World War I. So, what rights do these individuals have who do not belong, in some sense, to a polity? So, the right to have rights is a concept that tags very well with refugee rights because, well, let me put it this way, not all refugees are stateless or denaturalized. So, we cannot completely mix up these two categories, okay? And there are stateless who do become refugees, but they're also stateless, as in the case of the Rohingya, who do not cross international borders. Now, refugee rights emerge. They're based on Article 14 of the UDHR, that one has the right to claim asylum in another country other than the country of one's nationality or habitual residency, as it is called in the convention. This refugee right is, in that sense, distinct from other human rights because it is creating a transnational obligation. It is creating an obligation of states towards a specific group of human being. It is a human rights claim, but it is a distinct claim because it is asking the one that is vulnerable, the one that is outside, it is asking the other state for protection, for asylum. So, in that sense, it is not a human right, let's say, like the human right to medical care or the human right to shelter. It is making a transnational, I would say, in some sense, a kind of cosmopolitan claim. So that's the complicated relationship between human rights discourse and the rights of refugees.
We are kind of seeing a trend of offshoring of asylum, where wealthy nations pay other countries to handle refugee claims for them. Does a state lose its moral legitimacy when it outsources its legal obligation in this way? Why yes or why not?
I would say yes, in part because this outsourcing is done in such a way, number one, to avoid state responsibilities, but also to dilute or political hostility at home instead of, sort of facing up to it. But even probably more important than that is the fact that take something like the Italy-Libya agreement or Italy-Albania agreement. Once these agreements are concluded, the outsourcing state does not seem to have any obligations to monitor or control or to ascertain respect for human rights within these camps and refugee camp. Now, the story between Libya and Italy is really well documented. We know that the Italian Maritime Coast Guard that used to offer aid to these refugee boats, now, quite to the contrary, is using drones to identify these refugee boats and is even preventing human rights ships or groups that are organized to help refugees from reaching refugee boats and instead is aiding and abetting the Libyan ships, to come, Libyan Coast Guard to come and get refugee ships. This is a terrible story because it's also a completely racialized story. Most of the refugees coming, seeking to enter Italy from Libya are African origin, and they are grossly mistreated and punished by their Libyan masters in these camps. I mean, one hears all these horror stories. So the question emerges, do the outsourcing states have any kind of jurisdictional responsibility or obligation to monitor the conditions of the outsourcing? And why do they do this, or why don't they do this? I mean, the same kinds of questions can be raised about the UK and Uganda. There isn't that much documentation yet about what's going on there, or at least I haven't encountered it. But certainly it's a question. Does the UK have any obligation to these individuals once it has outsourced them there? The only example of a kind of outsourcing that got a bit complicated is the European Union-Turkey agreement. And this is complicated because, in effect, at the beginning, the refugee camps in Turkey were being strictly monitored there by the UN. After a while, Turkey asked the UN observers to leave, and it has its own refugee agreement system. And it seems to have been, for various reasons, both political and ethnic, that some of the majority of the migrants, passing through Turkey were of Muslim origin, particularly the Syrian migrants coming from the civil war, as well as Afghanis, etc. This seems to have worked out relatively better. Of course, there is mistreatment, but not torture, no stories of torture or abuse. People don't get jobs they want, etc. If I'm not mistaken, this is one story. So, the answer to your question is actually no, unless the outsourcing state finds itself in a position to also monitor and help rather than just like clean its hands off and accept human rights violations on these camps and sites. I won't even go into Greece because it is more of the same.
You kind of brought this topic of the drones up. So we often talk about the physical collapse of the international order, but what about the digital one, as states use AI and biometrics to track rights-bearing subjects before they even reach a border? Does this create a new kind of statelessness, even where a person exists physically but is digitally erased or even blocked?
This is a fascinating question. I haven't looked at this all that closely, but it is clear that technology is creating new frontiers. I mean, not only the development of AI technology in, whether particularly with the means of Frontex, but in general, these biometric indicators, are creating possibilities of control and deterrence that we hadn't thought of. My colleague Ayelet Shahar has a wonderful phrase. She says, "The eye of the state always follows you." Okay, so the eye of the state can simply be your cell phone. If you enter a country and you give your cell phone number, the cell phone, in a strange way, it can be the tracking device whereby your movements are followed. I don't know if this is exactly what you had in mind, but this is also an interesting dual-use technology because we were, in fact, discussing this at my Columbia class, at how during COVID, in countries like Singapore, the cell phone became a complete monitoring and control device, telling you where you could appear or where you could not, that you should not be in public buildings, that you should accept the curfew, etc. A Korean student was telling us that exactly this is what was happening, that their cell phones and even their watches were becoming these electronic monitors, where they were being told, before you would have had the curfew police, right? But this development of technology means, of course, that the movements of asylum seekers can be monitored and controlled much before they even arrive, and hence can be put off. I mean, I'm thinking of this group of Afghani refugees that were cheated by middlemen and that were brought to the Belarus border, thinking that they would be able to cross into Poland. I'm sure many of them were being followed because they all had to have cell phones in order to identify routes. So we are living in a we're moving into a very complicated domain where technology is also sort of changing the extent of our rights or, our capacity to claim them.
I told you I would bring this question up, but in Monday's lecture, you briefly mentioned the issue of non-refoulement and jus cogens. Could you briefly explain the concepts and elaborate on the point you made in the lecture?
Sure, I don't want to go into great detail because it seemed as if there was a lot anyways. Now, I use cogens is a particular category that refers to certain norms of international law, prohibition of genocide, prohibition of slavery, ethnic cleansing, and then quote-unquote gross human rights violations, and certainly non-refoulement, that is the rendering of one to seek who seeks asylum without proper procedures and care or under any circumstance to the country in which they fear torture or they have reasonable fear of damage to their life and freedom, etc. Now, I think there is agreement about jus cogens norms concerning genocide, slavery, including sexual slavery, ethnic cleansing, gross human rights violations, but then it becomes fuzzy. And jus cogens refers to the fact that the obligations of states to live by these norms do not arise out of signatures to conventions or rights declarations. The claim is that whether or not you are a signatory to the Genocide Convention, you do not commit genocide. Okay? And so, non-refoulement, which is the principal category of the 51 Convention, the obligation to grant refuge, many scholars want to include this as a jus cogens category. I shouldn't say that this is uncontested. There is discussion about it. I think I agree with those scholars who say that it should be a jus cogens category, and increasingly the Convention on Torture and Violent Treatment is also being used to supplement, some of the obligations arising from 51. But as you can see, again, this brings us back in a way to the issue of philosophy. How do you construct the content of jus cogens, and what do we mean when we say gross human rights violations? There is always a kind of, we say, okay, genocide, slavery, ethnic cleansing, and then we go, et cetera, et cetera. How do we fill in that et cetera of what we should like to see as jus cogens? I mean, that argument is normative, a philosophical argument. It isn't just a legal argument. So that's why I wasn't going to, that's why I didn't want to exactly get into it in a constrained period of time.
I was really interested in it, so I was happy that I could ask you in the interview about
Good.
it. So I have two concluding questions. So how do you stay hopeful in chaotic and dark times that we are currently in?
I think there is always something, some kind of political action that emerges. I mean, for me, the reaction of people in Minnesota and the resistance to ICE that we see all over the country is an extremely good sign. This means that people really, they talk about everyday fabric of their communities. Their neighbors are not just legal categories, documented, undocumented, lawful, unlawful. They're human beings with whom they have shared a life, with whom they share communities, schools, their children play, etc. So I think this is an extremely good development, and I'm always looking for such pockets of resistance, because I believe resistance is always possible. And I think that I see transformations also in human consciousness, in this area.
Finally, what advice do you have for undergraduate students who are studying or want to go into this field?
To stick to their principles, to stick to their interests. It's a difficult field because there is a lot of misery and sadness in it. There is the sadness of not seeing, let's say, an asylum seeker that you are defending being granted asylum. I hear this all the time from law students who are working in legal clinics. They write these credible fear interview protocols, and then when their adopted person is turned down, there is a great deal of sadness and discouragement. So I think one should be alert to the fact that there is a lot of human suffering also involved in this. But also, it's a time, particularly because of what's happening in the United States, where international institutions have been grossly weakened. And we have to see whether there will be a process of reconstruction. I think there will be, because otherwise the world will move towards war. I don't see an alternative, but I think that there are forces that will prevent that. I mean, the level of interdependence in the international community is such that we cannot do without having these institutions. Like one example that I really find mind-boggling, why would the United States withdraw from the World Health Organization, right? I mean, it makes no rational sense. And we know that it is bad politics, and hopefully bad politics will come to an end.
Thank you so much for your time. This concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down and having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Isa. A pleasure to meet you, and I wish you and all your friends, good luck. It was a pleasure to visit the campus. It was very nice. Also, question and answer period. So I go, back encouraged.